Hi, friends. My name is Frank. I'm an alcoholic. And good to be in your company. You're a good-looking crowd. I'll say that for you. I see some agreement out there. I don't know where we'll go with this little bit. I think you're all in service, though, and that's nice. It's nice to be in an environment of where people participate and put themselves into the thing. I had a nice dinner with Jean and Linda and chef salad, and then I had Pat got me some carrot cake, and so I'm filled with lots of goodies. And I drank for power. I didn't have power without a drink in my hand. With a drink in my hand, I could say yes to life. I cared about you. I wanted to hear whatever it was you had to say. I could take my time when I was drinking. I was unhurried. And I drank for nerve. I had a lot of confidence when I drank. I didn't have confidence when I wasn't drinking. I was frightened. Every alcoholic in the room knows the toxicology of fear. Fear has its own penetrating poisons into every aspect of our lives. And fear says no, don't do, don't risk, don't whatever. And alcohol was an antidote to that. The negative voices quieted when I drank. And I began to hear a different drummer. I began to have firings of imagination when I drank. I could see possibilities in a life drinking that I could not see or went unseen when I was not drinking. I come from a family, I'm so excited about it, with grave emotional and mental disorders. My heart used to pound when they read that in the fifth chapter. There are those two with grave emotional mental disorders, but they can get better, blah, 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 blah. If they have the capacity to be honest, my heart would pound some more because I knew I was never honest. I always felt fraudulent. Short of a blackout, I always felt like a phony. I was never comfortable. People would say, be yourself, and I wondered who they meant. You know, what should I do here? Later on, I was to learn there's a terminology for that, multiple personality disorders. You're so busy giving people what they want that you're never who you're supposed to be. I knew how to package myself. I just never knew how to be myself. Drinking helped me to find my own voice. I felt I had something to say when I drank, and I thought you wanted to hear it. And hear it, and hear it, because I'd often get stuck screaming the same thing. But I could sing when I drank. I could tell stories. I could laugh at your jokes. If I wasn't drinking, I was so nervous that I wouldn't laugh at the appropriate part of the joke, so self-centered that I'd be in agony worrying about people watching me respond to your joke. You know, that paralyzing self-centeredness that, I don't know if you do, but I suffered from. I was a kind of kid apparently very bright early and relatively happy until teenage years. And then the crush came. And I identify with kids who suicide in their teens. Life was so dark for me. It had no promise. I was engulfed with my own paralyzing self-consciousness that there was no out for me until I found alcohol. And it was hallway drinking, prophetically, out of a brown paper bag before the grammar school graduation, and it did everything we know alcohol does to you. What I liked about alcoholism was there was no long training program necessary. You know, you got right at it. And I used to say, it costs what it cost. I knew I was in a game over my head. I remember in the Army, I was a biologist, so we had access to lab alcohol. All we had to do, 180 proof, all we had to do was buy the mix. And we didn't have much money for mix, so there wasn't much mix. It was a lot of alcohol. And so I was drunk all the time from the Army. I couldn't get my hands on much alcohol before the Army, but from the day I, not the day, after basic training, from the day I went down to Kentucky to the research lab, until the day I entered AA, I drank every day. And most of those days, I drank as much as I could get. because I could get alcohol. In the Army, I was, as I say, a biologist, and we had lab alcohol parties. And in addition to that, I worked as a bartender at the officers' club. So in those days, I was into rum and tonic. I would get stuck places. I would learn that this was a fashionable drink, and I'd stick that. That was a signature for me, you know. Rum and tonic. Frank has a rum and tonic. I like that when people knew what you were drinking. You know, that you're, like Cheers, you know, you want to go to a place where people know your name. You know, the little introductory song to Cheers. That was a big component to my alcoholism. I felt noticed when I drank, and I wanted to be. Alcohol, the right brands were important to me, just like cigarettes. Cigarettes told you who I was, my brand, and alcohol was the same way. By myself, privately, I'd smoke anything or eat anything or drink anything, but publicly, it was Ballantine scotch. It was kind of Quaker middle class, I thought. It wasn't top shelf, which was ostentatious, nor, you know, the rot gut they serve bar stuff. It was just, it showed you had a, you cared. You know, that kind of stuff was very important to me. I didn't care, but I wanted to present myself as caring. As I said, my whole life was packaging. I fabricated myself. I didn't have anything to work with except what I stole from you. I didn't steal money from people, but I stole parts of their personality, how they spoke, the books they read. I was, even as a kid, I was into reading the New Yorker every week, and I would have an enormous vocabulary of words I'd never heard pronounced. So I'd be talking to people, and they wouldn't know what I was talking about, you know, because I'd mispronounce the words. They knew I cared, and I, you know, was trying to make sense, but they wouldn't have any clue with what I was. Either they'd never heard the words, I mean, they didn't have that kind of vocabulary, or they'd heard them properly pronounced and couldn't associate them with the way I was doing it. So, and the humiliation of being corrected when people said, "Do you mean this, Frank?" Oh, I remember that. My humiliations, my public humiliations got my attention. Shame is my most powerful emotion because pride is my biggest sin. You know, I wanted to look, present myself as perfect and present myself as somebody I wasn't. And as soon as that wasn't possible, I fell apart. Anyone watched me drink, they would have said, that man wants unconscious time. That man wants to smash his five senses as fast as he could. Because I never measured a drink in my life. If I went to somebody's house and they produced a jigger, I'd say, my God, it's going to be a long night. You know, one for you and one for me, and then they put everything away. By the time they rejoined me, I'd finished, chewed up the ice, finished the drink, and nibbling on the glassware. I mean, I just had a thirst. Somebody said that about Judy Garland. She just had a thirst. I never had a thermostat. You know, I see people who, they don't notice there's a glass of wine in front of them at their dinner table, or they sip it and forget about it or whatever, ignore it. I never ignored my drink or yours. I would leave some of the best restaurants on the planet and finishing drinks, other people's drinks. And I thought I had class, you know. But I never had the thermostat that tells people they've had enough. I hear people say, I've had enough. Words never came out of my mouth. I never felt it. People would scream it on my behalf. He's had enough. But I never felt it. You know, I always felt I was kind of shifting into second gear, you know, kind of getting ready to go out. And I always wanted to go out. You couldn't nail my feet to the floor. You know, alcohol and cars and booze and cigarettes were all enmeshed in one big ball. I had to have the car keys because I had to go places. You know, dream dreams and go and meet new people. If I was in this bar, my head would be somewhere else. Well, what are they doing down the street? You know, I'd have to go to 13 bars in the night kind of thing. I'm running between them, you know, that kind of frenzy, cornered rat kind of thing, missing something. You know, once the furnace was ignited, I couldn't stop it. It's like, you know, if you start a fireplace in the winter, it takes a long time to get the first log going. The second one goes faster. And then pretty soon you're just throwing them in because it's so hot and it just incinerates in the moment. And that's the way alcohol was in me. You know, once I started, it would just vaporize. I mean, I'd hardly feel it, I felt. I'd always be surprised how drunk I'd become. You know, I didn't mind being drunk even. In fact, it's probably the one I wanted, though. If you watch me drink, you'd say that man wants to be drunk quick. But I was always startled that I was drunk. And I hated to be drunk in the sense of losing control. You know, I hated to be shamed, you know, not being able to speak properly and be conscious of it, or getting up off a bar stool and weaving or falling or anything. That out of control things that happen when you drink large quantities of alcohol, you just become a mess. And anyway, my alcoholism brought me before great people, and I had a lot to say when I got there. I started off very humble surroundings, so my alcoholism opened up doors for me. I mean, I was able to get and hold jobs and move into a lifestyle that wasn't mine by inheritance or anything. This person I fabricated had certain entitlements to a life that I never had myself. And so alcohol worked for upward social mobility for me. I was able to live a different kind of life than my family did. And that fed my ego. You know, if anyone said, hey, Frank, you better be careful, I would say, how much do you earn? Where do you live? What kind of lifestyle do you have? Because I knew I was running at some level. And but I had this external manifestation of success for a while. And so I got my payoff from the devil. You know, I got what I wanted or needed or felt I needed. You know, I went to live in California and had that kind of lifestyle, and worked for drug companies, advertising departments of drug companies, so I had limited access to pills. I just had to ask for a trade package of any pill. And for 7 years, I took pills on a daily basis. And I took pills to medicate acute alcoholism. As I say, I didn't mind being a drunk. I didn't want to look like one or act like one. So I took diuretics so I wasn't bloated. I took tranquilizers so I didn't shake to death. And I took amphetamine so I could focus, because I was just so crazy in my head. And I met a SIBA man at a party once, and he said, Ritalin's postponed blackouts. So I never went forth without a Ritalin every night, thinking I'd get another half hour of conscious time in this little experience. You know, just... anything that made sense, I'd take. Protected by an ego that said the rules of life didn't apply to me. If you drank and took pills and drove, I'd say, be careful. You're a fool. Why, I drank and took pills, walk around like a little apothecary shop, and unlimited, washing them down, flushing them down with enormous quantities of alcohol. I never went anywhere without travelers. I mean, beer, I didn't even think beer. I thought if you were drinking beer, you were giving your liver a rest. You know, I thought kind of quiet time with beer. You know, somebody had told me there were vitamin Bs in beer, so I would imagine my body happily and, you know, flooded with these little vitamins when I wasn't drinking wall-to-wall scotches or rum sours or something. And anyway, I was able... to move around the planet. One thing I did inherit was an enormous capacity to drink. I had peasant bones and peasant muscles and whatever, a lot of stamina to drink. The good go early, you know, and the King Kongs roam the planet drunk and careening off things. I had lots of automobile wrecks, as you can imagine, out of Yamaha in California, and I was scared to death of it. I had to be drunk to get on it. Because I was afraid, and I had reason to be afraid. I kept falling off it. And, you know, and everything you learn to do with your feet, you do with your hands on a motorcycle. So, I mean, you get all these, what am I supposed to do, kind of thought patterns going. And also, when you stop it, I would know I was supposed to put my foot down, but I'd forget, or I'd be so numb I couldn't do it. And the thing would quietly tip over when I stopped it. And that didn't even bother me. But when people watched me tip over, you know, the car next to me watched me tip over, I remember a man got out one time and said, "Can I help you?" I felt like such a fool. I said, "Yeah, if you can get it started, help me get it started, I'll be all right." And it was true. If it was going, I could handle it. It was when it stopped, I couldn't do it. It was like a little kid on a bicycle. You know, you run with them to get them started, and the man did it. He said, "Okay." You know, people are very cooperative trying to help you get home. And I had lots of trips to emergency rooms. You know, I could do a qualification on emergency rooms. One, I was in and out of a blackout screaming. I always cut my eyes. For some reason, I guess I wanted to stop seeing. You know, I always think there's a metaphor in our accidents. Accidents aren't accidents. They're trying to tell us something. And I try to analyze my accidents, and I think I was trying not to see because I always had eye problems when I fell. I'd do damage to my eyes. So I remember somebody was sewing up my eye one time, and I was screaming. I wanted to go to Switzerland. I didn't want some jerk on the emergency room, you know, 10 minutes of study how to sew. You know, I imagined my face like that when he was through with it. And what he was a pediatrician, and I had to go to his office to have the stitches removed. So I sat on little people furniture, big drunk, smelling of booze out of every pore, you can imagine, and Demetis, a fool. But the funny lines, you know, I'd always been the class clown. You can always tell somebody who's going to be in a lot of trouble, they're the class clown. And I was the class clown. Funny lines all over, you know, to mask the acute pain, which I can't acknowledge and own my own suffering. Talk about, might come from a family, we could talk about anything except if it was important. And coming out of the, after he'd finished, I said, "Don't you get a balloon or a lollipop?" And he didn't think it was funny at all. He just said, "Frank, be careful." And I knew exactly what he meant. Every once in a while, I would be at a party or something, and I'd know there was somebody in the room who knew I was a phony. And that would just make me crazy. You know, I knew that they could see through me. And he was one of the people. I just knew he, you know, I was invisible. My whole masks and little dances and persona and projections and all this bullshit, he saw right through it. And every once in a while, I'd meet somebody like that. I'd encounter somebody like that. Anyway, I bubbled along. By the way, I'm always amazed that the AA has the irony to ask the alcoholic to tell their story. My neighbor knows more specific details about my alcoholism, looking through her curtains, you know, because I was in a blackout from the beginning. And also, if I thought I'd be talking about my story so frequently and for so long, I would have paid more attention, you know. Alcoholism isn't paying attention. It's going through the stop signs. You know, it's not hearing, seeing, feeling, tasting what your body and your friends are telling you. You know, I came into AA saying, "Why didn't anyone tell me?" Everybody told me. Their eyes told me. Their attitudes told me. You know, they did everything but scream it at me. And a lot of them did that, too. And every cell in my body told me what I'd become. You know, if you're an alcoholic and you drink, you become what you hate the most. An Demetis fool I'd become. Urinating over myself in some of the prettiest hotels and with some of the most gifted people on the planet. That's the reality of my alcoholism. Losing control. The thing I worried most about doing is what I produced. I come from a family, my mother's a manic depressive. I was born in a mental hospital, and I was always careful never to look crazy because I knew she lost her vote by letting people know what was going on in her mind. You know, they just put her away. And I knew anything could go on in your mind as long as you were careful what you said. And I was very careful what I said. Until the end of my drinking, crazy stuff came out of me. "Thy tongue shall utter perverse things," the Bible says, alcoholism. And my tongue uttered a lot of perverse things, not in my own self-interest. So I produced what I hated the most, insanity, public insanity. I didn't mind being privately insane. publicly insane was something else. Just and with any kind of consciousness. Anyone who watched me would have said, that man's trying to smash his five senses as fast as he could. He doesn't want to live his life. And yet if you asked me, I was going for the brass ring. I wanted to live a life where I could fly to Paris for lunch. You know, those were my values. You know, have the big house on the hill, have a job with a place full of Henry Moore sculptures. You know, and a lot of that stuff I was able to produce in my life, but I was never happy, I was never comfortable, and I never owned them. I always felt uncomfortable. I always felt I was a visitor, an intruder, really, into that life. I knew it wasn't mine. And I was careening. You know, alcoholism is careening all over the planet with a drink in your hand. And that's what I'd become. In the end, I hadn't worked in a year, which got my attention, because if you ever asked me about myself, I sounded like my job resume. You know, all of my self-descriptiveness came from what I did, not from who I was. If you don't know who you are, you got to fabricate and make up stuff. And you make it up from where you can get it. You know, I got it from a job resume, I got it from who I knew, I got it from a lifestyle, material things. You know, if you feel you don't have any intrinsic value, you grab what's ever handy. And that's what I had done. And in the end, all those toys were gone. I had stuff left. I had a nice apartment in New York. I had a house in the country. I had some things left, but I didn't own them. I was very uncomfortable. I lived like an animal. And what alcohol had always done for me was bring me out of myself. In the end, I couldn't get out of myself. I could rarely get out of the apartment. And if I got out of the apartment, I live on West 79th Street, I could never get past, or rarely get past, Dublin House before I went in there for a couple of beers. And I wouldn't be drunk. I wouldn't be, you know, in a blackout or anything. I'd be that kind of sobriety you can't drink enough to break. You know, that just so painfully self-conscious. You can't get any unconscious time. So I'd sit there drinking beer after beer after beer after beer after beer, unable to move off the chair to call whoever I was supposed to meet or whatever. And then finally, when it was real dark or something, I'd go back home and finish the job. You know, that kind of stuff. So as I say, if you drink and you're an alcoholic, you become what you hate the most, whatever that is. And that's the reality. I wound up in AA. I came in AA in June, which is the best month to come to AA. Of course, you stick to those chairs in June, July, and August, if you're a sweater like I am. And it's hard to leave with the chair stuck to you and not be noticed if you're a people pleaser. That man's leaving with a chair. So I stayed, and I stayed with all the nobility that if you took a bug with enough velocity against that wall, the body juices of the bug would adhere it to the wall. My alcoholism was violent enough to propel me into those chairs that I stuck, and I hope yours was too, because everything is in the sticking. And immediately, the thing is, when we start to get better, the disease comes back and says, I don't belong here. I'm not as bad as these people. All of those things, me. I should be getting a job, not sitting with these people. You know, I was always nervous. The hour with AA, I should be doing something. You know, that's when I was attacked most by the need to go look for work. Was the rest of the time I could easily forget looking for work. But in the hour of AA, this unrest, I've got to do something. I'm just wasting time here, whatever. You know, all the demons came when I was in an AA meeting, as much as elsewhere, the thought. But anyway, a lot of stuff, I've always been fascinated with AA. I love the humor. I think I had my first real belly laughs in the early part of AA. You know, a guy would stand up and tell a story. He took all the money. He burned down the house. He ran over his wife in the driveway, left the baby on the bus, and everybody be lining up to thank the man after the story. Fred, you really helped me. You know, and the more carnage in the story, the better we feel. Oh, that was a wonderful story. You know, he was in 14 mental hospitals and tubes up his nose for 2 years and all this stuff. And, oh, that it really helped me. you know, kind of a black humor kind of thing about it, which took, it took the incredible intensity off me. You know, when Sylvia Plath died, suicided, they wrote that Sylvia overvalued her own sorrows. And boy, did that resonate for me. Anything that happened to me was heavy. You know, you could have killed your mother, I'd say no big thing. It's been done before. You know, Shakespeare wrote about it. Pull yourself together, don't tell the others, and get on. You know, no big thing. I'd always minimize other people's grief, other people's problem. Mine was horrendous. If I had a pimple, I was inconsolable. You know, and the more people tried to help me by saying, you know, it's not that bad a pimple, Frank, you know, the worse it got, you know, in my head, easy for them to say. You know, they don't have this fulminating thing on their face. You know, and really get like that. You know, my secrets were very, very important. And I come from a family like that. We always kept our mouth shut. You know, we would go to the grave with these things. You know, my mother is in 13 courses of electrical shock, a sea of psychiatrists, and one time she was having a new psychiatrist, and it sounded promising. And I said, well, you really like her, huh? And she said, don't worry, I won't tell her anything. Like I should be worried that she should tell her something. But that's the, I remember once I was borrowing some money from her, and she said, what do you do with your money? And I said, I was under analysis, and she said, are you crazy? You know, that was the way we handle those kinds of thoughts. You know, by instantly asserting that we were okay. You know, every alcoholic is fine. If you ask me, whenever drunk or sober, I'm always fine. You know, fresh rope burns on my neck, but I'm fine. You know, it's the nature. You know, always. You know, the others better look after themselves, but I'm fine. You know, and well, I found out with the steps, I ain't so fine. You know, I began to look at my behavior and see that I do. It's one thing to behave insanely when you're drunk. There's another thing to watch yourself do self-destructive things again and again in sobriety. You know, why do I say no when I mean yes? Why do I move away from people I yearn to be with? I'll feel my body going this way when I really want to stay. You know, those kinds of things. Hear myself say no. On the phone, somebody said, hey, look, you want to go here to the country for a weekend? And I hear myself say, no, other plans, whatever. Anything where I have a feeling that I may be out of control or something. You know, I may not be in control. And what comes up for me first is no, don't do it. Don't take the risk. AA is the only thing that on a regular basis has been able to break through that kind of neurotic isolation, you know, and I need vast amounts of AA. I didn't stay drunk on marginal amounts of drinking. You know, I didn't have a glass or two of wine a week. I had a lot of booze to stay drunk, and I have to have a lot of a spiritual program to stay happy, sober, and useful. You know, I need a critical mass to tip me over out of my nature is to be negative. I can spend 5 minutes with my Uncle Frank and know exactly why I drank. I drank to change that consciousness. You know, he listens 24 hours a day, the radio's on playing, give me 22 minutes and I'll give you the world. Give me 22 minutes and I'll give you the world, whatever station that is. They just play the same neurotic, crazy, negative news over and over again. And so, you know, whatever that comes out to be, 170 million times, he gets bad news. So no wonder he's unhappy and fearful all the time. And that's the way I'd be. You know, I'd hold on to my negative thing. You know, what's wrong with this picture? I'd know in a second. I can pay 10 bills and not pay two, and that's what will ring in my ear. A lot of people can say positive things about me. Somebody criticizes me, and that's a chunk of my day gone. But AA to me is about emotional sobriety. It's what do you do with a life you never wanted to live? You know, anyone watching me drink would have said that man doesn't want to live his life, he wants to smash it. You know, I wasn't afraid of dying, I was afraid of living. You know, I was suiciding on a daily basis. And when I got sober for the first 4.5 years of my recovery, I couldn't get suicide out of my head. Hanging myself was the way I thought I'd do it. I didn't think I'd actually do it that way, you know, leave ugly scars and things. But that was my consciousness. And I really see today, I wanted my head to stop. When I stopped taking massive amounts of a known sedative, my head went crazy. Every negative thought I'd ever run from was waiting for me there. You know, can't do, you'll never work again. I'd, like most alcoholics, I'd burned every bridge. Anyone who loved me, I pushed away. And I was publicly drunk. I'd humiliate myself again and again. And you, if you cared about me, you know, had to burn all of it at the end. And so A is about, what do you do with a life you never wanted to live? What do you do about emotional sobriety? What do you do so you're not eaten up by your lusts, by your rages, by the other things that go on in your life? You know, what do I eat more than I want? Why did I smoke? You know, I stopped drinking, so I smoked twice as much. I was choking from smoking, eating when I wasn't hungry. I mean, all of the things that we, sex was a narcotic, you know, and it's a high-risk game today, you know, under ideal conditions. And so, I mean, all of those things that I would use just to get a minute's peace are no longer available to me. So what do you do with all those nerve ends but search for a God? Some kind of, somebody in AA early on said, everybody has a God in their life, Frank. You just have to name yours. And I had lots of gods in my life. Alcohol, of course, drugs, money, sex. Your opinion was a big one. That determined how I felt about myself. Whatever. I had lots of things to... And somebody said, too, whatever you think about is what you worship. And what I thought about 99.7% of the time was me. You know, how am I getting over? What's this mean to me? You know, even if I was listening to your story, my head in the early years would be centered on myself. And so it told me who my God was when I got clear on that. You know, and so it's been a long... the only thing I think, I've been sober some time now, and I would have told you when, if we were in Texas, however we're not, we're in Westchester, I know that today because I'm sober, and we don't have to do that, but I'm more vulnerable now in a lot of ways than when I walked into AA. It would be spiritually arrogant for me to believe, because I've been sober a while, that I'm always going to be thus unless I'm careful. That's not the reality of alcoholism. The reality of alcoholism, recovered alcoholics are more vulnerable when they're successful than when they're failures. You know, when I fail at something, I get quiet. I might listen to you. I might even ask for help. I might try to change. But if I'm winning at life, you can't tell me anything. You know, you might be talking, but my head saying, shit, what does he make? What does he make an hour? What kind of car does he drive? Where does he live? What books does that jerk read? You know, all of the ego stuff to keep people away, you know, come back and separate, not connect, but separate me from people. You know, that's why you used to hear an AA say things like, I hope you have a slow recovery. And as you see, I've had a slow one, so I've been fortunate. My other people's wishes for me came true. But I was able to build roots. I wasn't going to work at a regular job for a year after I got to AA. So I was able to go to 2 or 3 meetings a week. I was able to build a community of other people. We were talking about that at dinner. How vital. Alcoholics don't stay sober by themselves. They need another community, you know, statistically. And we all know or have heard of people who drank after 32 years or 14 years or 7 years. I mean, they're all around. You just have to listen, go to a lot of meetings and listen. So it's spiritually arrogant for me to believe I'm always going to be sober unless I'm careful. I got to listen to myself. I have to listen to my own history, and I have to accommodate that by adaptability with the 12 steps. The only tools I have for dealing with stress in my life today are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can rail about it. I have prayer and meditation. to deal with stress. And I'm a very stressful person. You know, I pick it up. If I'm in a bank and some other people are quarreling on the next line, I want to get into it. Now, you let her go first, and you wait your turn. You came in after the lady with the bags, you know, running all kinds of stuff. I don't know a thing about it, but I'm into it. Automatically. My dog's like that, too. Other dogs are quarreling. He wants to fight, too. It's the Irish thing. Is this a private fight, or can anybody get in it? You know, kind of. Just to stir things up, just to get things. And with a car, I can be insane with an automobile. You know, somebody cut me off. Instant insanity. I mean, hours of preparation and spiritual exercises are gone in an instant. And I'm full of drugged, my own production of drugs. And that's the issue. I can be drunk without picking up a drink, an external exogenous chemical, because I can produce my own that'll make me insane. We all know what lust is, you know. We all know what blind, crazy, self-destructive moves are, you know, anger, rages, envy, things that will diminish our own lives. In an instant, like a summer storm, suddenly, it's not worth the bother. You know, that's why we can't underestimate the presence of evil on the planet. You know, if we lived in the 15th century, we'd be comfortable talking about demons, being possessed by demons, being forces of evil. And in my own experience, that's very, very true. I can be taken over in a very sudden way by demonic forces, people that have me, forces that make me act against my own self-interest. You know, and that's what I need protection from. And we have a program, a precise program for dealing with negativity in our personal lives, and we have a community, AA, to stay together, because if I lose it today, if I'm nibbled to death by my demons, I can grab on your strength and take your hand, and you can lead me until I return to some stability, some emotional stability, emotional recovery, emotional sobriety, and begin again to walk the path, put one foot in front of the other, and recover. You know, we don't get permanent remission from this thing called alcoholism. It's contingent, as our big book says, on our spiritual condition today. I didn't stay drunk on yesterday's drinking. I had to add fresh alcohol today to stay drunk. And I can't stay happy, sober, and useful on yesterday's spiritual awakening, yesterday's spiritual experience, yesterday's service. We have to have something in our life that makes us feel good about ourselves today. You know, that adds a dimension and a character to life today. Otherwise, I get stale, and I don't care. That's what engulfs me. I just lose interest. It's not worth the bother, is really what gets me. Because I need spirit in my life. I drank for spirit. I drank to be able to go for the brass ring. I drank to care, to have passions and zeal and senses of bonding with people. I love kitchens at 2 and 3 in the morning. You know, kitchens are holy places. We cared about each other. You know, one more drink and we could wrap it up. You know, we were very close to it, whatever it was. And that's where I want to live my life. And we can do that in AA. You know, we can capture that passion and sense of caring. Is it time? Oh. I don't want to run over. I just think we have 12 steps for emotional sobriety individually. And we have 12 traditions about our emotional sobriety as a society. Because in California, I heard the expression, my group went out again. I kind of understood it. Group went crazy. You know, it stopped being a gathered meeting where we all sense heal. Everybody in the room who's been around AA for any length of time knows what a gathered AA meeting is. It's magic. You feel your life getting clear. You have access to information you don't have anywhere else on the planet. You have a certain quality of understanding deep within you. I'm going to be okay. My life up to now has purpose. My pain has a redemptive quality to it. You know, a guy, Thomas Lewis, a biology writer, who was the medical director of Sloan Kettering Hospital, very wonderful man who worked in a very depressing place. I mean, most people coming to Sloan Kettering are on their way out of here. And he wrote this book, Lives of a Cell, and he describes bees. One or two bees by themselves are lethargic and die. Bees can't live by themselves. But you put a bee in a hive, every bee has a purpose in the hive. No bee is superfluous to the hive. Every bee is necessary. There's an intelligence in the hive and work to be done in a hive that doesn't exist in the individual bees. And I believe that that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. That's a metaphor for Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody in AA has a job and is necessary. Only you can deliver the message to the people, to the alcoholics who are still drinking, in the way that you can do it. You can deal in a vocabulary in a way that I can't. I won't reach those people with the way you can. Everybody has a piece of it. And you hear that in stories. You know, and you will see that in your meeting. You know, somebody you can't stand reaches 11 brand new people. You know? I remember I answered phones after 90, I think on my 91st day, there were 12 or 13 phones here. I not only answered my own perfectly, but I audited the other 12. You know, I was listening to everything they said. Now, of course, I only heard one part of the conversation, but I knew all of it. And I knew that I should be getting that call too, because those people weren't doing it right. You know, that kind of neurotic thing, only I can do it all right. And I see now it's the reverse of that, that everybody has their job to do in AA. And the reason we're not as more effective is because we don't do our job simply. You know, for me to be effective today, I have to use the 12 steps the most effective way I can be. If I want to hit max, I got to be God conscious 24 hours a day rather than the few minutes or hour that I'm God conscious in my life. So I'm not hitting anything near my efficacy rate. And I think as a society, we're not hitting anything near our efficacy rate either, because we're not a gathered meeting a great deal of the time. We're not AA, as my friends say. Sometimes we're BB. You don't hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in the room. You don't know what it is, but it isn't this, it's something else. And I think we can all get clear on that. I have to become conscious of my own life, and we have to become conscious of our collective lives. We have to begin monitoring, not like I have to monitor my own condition to see if I'm emotionally sober at this moment. Collectively, we have to begin to get conscious of our rooms. Who are we asking to lead the meeting? What questions are being asked? You know, a lot of the groups, including my own, we're taking our own inventory at the end of this month. Half the people leave after the qualification at the break, and they don't come back. And they're the most sober members in time in the group. There's something very seriously wrong, that they can't stay an hour. You know? And I'm not blaming them, I'm blaming us. What is it that we've lost our attractiveness? You know, why don't people stay? Why, if we were really giving them what we all know AA has the capacity to do, more of the time together, we would be more effective. We'd want to be together more. We wouldn't want to bolt out at the break. You know, we wouldn't want to miss anything. You know, when we drank, we didn't want to miss anything. I loved a woman in my group. I loved her since the first time she spoke. She said her favorite drink was the next one. And that's the way I get in AA. My favorite story is the next one. My favorite miracle is the next one I'll hear, my own or whatever. We have 12 traditions to gather the meeting and protect us from ourselves. Just want to read a couple of things from Bill, you know, that always resonates. You know, I don't personally have to be perfect anymore since I'm in AA. I can have my character defects, and some of you see them and know of them and talk among yourselves about them. But Bills always says about AA itself, implicit throughout AA's traditions is the confession that our fellowship has its sins. We confess that we have character defects as a society and that these defects threaten us continually. Our traditions are a guide to better ways of working and living, and they are also an antidote to our various maladies. The 12 traditions are to group survival and harmony what AA's 12 steps are to each member's sobriety and peace of mind. But the 12 traditions also point straight to many of our individual defects. By implication, they ask each of us to lay aside pride and resentment. They ask for personal as well as group sacrifice. They ask us never to use the AA name in any quest for personal power, distinction, or money. The traditions guarantee the equality of all members and the independence of all groups. They show how we may best relate ourselves to each other and to the world outside. They indicate how we can best function in harmony as a great whole. For the sake of the welfare of the entire society, traditions ask that every individual in every group in every area in AA shall lay aside all desires, ambitions, and untoward actions that could bring serious division among us or to lose us the confidence of the world at large. You know, we're not the first alcoholics that have gotten sober in quantities before. You know, the Washingtonians were alive and well just before our Civil War. And at one time, there were 600,000 recovered sots in the Washingtonians. These were alcoholics helping each other that spontaneously developed in Baltimore. You can read about them a little bit in AA Comes of Age. And the population of the country was 20 million in 1865. AA would have to be 10 million in this country to have the same ratio as the Washingtonians. And who ever heard of the Washingtonians today? Our own immediate ancestors, the Oxford groups, both Bill and Bob, those of you who read the histories, got sober in the Oxford groups. Who heard of the Oxford groups today? One time they filled the Hollywood Bowl, 27,000 members, another 10,000 stood outside, couldn't get in. Most major politicians in this country were members of the Oxford groups. Who ever heard of them? I'm just telling you, because we're here now and can fill pretty rooms and convention centers with 50,000 is no guarantee we're always going to be around unless we're careful. I have to personally be careful for my own sobriety, and we have to be collectively careful for holding this thing together. Our name is Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people don't think we should be alcoholic. We should be a lot of other stuff too, and a lot of people don't think we should be anonymous. We're 57 years old, and I wonder if we're not Alcoholics Anonymous, what would we be? And where would we be, and how would we be 57 years from today if we lose our way? It's easy for me to forget if I'm not in my own history. You know, Carl Sandburg wrote that whenever society or civilization perishes, there's always one condition present. They forgot where they came from. If I forget I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to get recycled, if I'm lucky, and get another chance at coming back. Or maybe I'll just be recycled and put into whatever debris bags they collect. And that's true of us as a society, too. Unless we're careful and keep this gift precious and fragile, it can be damaged. I'm glad you listened. I'm going to end with something that came across my desk, came out of California. Some of you might recognize it. It's a Dear Abby thing, just to show you we've got a lot of work to do, and we got to get busy. Dear Abby, I'm a sailor in the U.S. Navy and also have a cousin who belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. Have you all heard this before? This letter? No. I have a cousin who belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. My father has epilepsy and my mother has syphilis, so neither of them work. They are totally dependent on my two sisters, who are prostitutes in Louisville, because my only brother is serving a life term in prison for rape and murder. I am in love with a streetwalker who operates near our base. She knows nothing of my background, but she says she loves me. We intend to get married as soon as she settles her bigamy case, which is now in court. When I get out of the Navy, we intend to move to Detroit and open a small house. My problem Abby, is this. In view of the fact that I intend to make this girl my wife and bring her into my family, should I or should I not tell her about my cousin who's an AA? Thanks for listening. I hope you have a nice life.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. Please check out our website at sobrietytalks.com. You can also contact us by sending an email to sobrietytalks@aol.com. Thank you.